So good morning and welcome to Kadampa Center. Last Saturday morning, Venerable Robina led part of the meditation from Lama Zepa Rinpoche's new advised daily meditation booklet. So there are copies of that available on the back table. Please feel free to take one, and at the end of the day today, you're welcome to take it home to help you in your daily practice. And there are still a few of the course notes left on that back table, which are the notes written by Venerable Robina for her visit, expanding on a lot of the topics that she's been teaching on, and those are also being provided as a gift from the center for you. I sent out last night an email to our official email list with the links to the PDFs, which will also be available just during the time of her visit. So if you want to get the PDFs for free, get them in the next day or so. Okay?
So just first couple of minutes, just close our eyes and just focus on something. Try to focus the mind, that's all. So just use the breath. It's very simple. Breath happens anyway, naturally. So we just anchor our mind to the breath. Think like that. That sensation at the tip of your nose. Just with determination, you know, for 2 minutes, I will not miss one breath. Just watch the breath go out. Watch the breath come in. Watch the breath go out like that. That's it. Nothing, there's no special thing, no special feeling to have, nothing to think about. Just like as if you're on the edge of a cliff, and if you lose awareness for a second, you fall over, you know. So you're going to be super sharp, super aware, focused. That's it for 2 minutes. Just watch the breath. Can you close the door, let me? Just the breath. That's it. Just the breath. Okay, relax. So we just sing this little refuge prayer. We're thinking we're going to listen, think, analyze, discuss, taking us one step forward on this internal journey we're on, each one of us, you know, which is the job of knowing our minds, having confidence we can change them and develop them all the way Buddha would say, to this outrageous level of completely ridding the minds of all the nonsense and fully developing all the goodness, really, is what he's saying. So one step. Every day, one step on that journey, our own internal path, using the tools that we can take in our life to help us achieve that. This is why we're sitting here. And then we can help others do the same thing. Sange charang soke chok nam la jang cho baru dag ni kyab su chi jagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la penche sange drobha shok Sange charang soke chok nam la jang cho baru dag ni kyab su chi jagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la penche sange drobha shok Sange charang soke chok nam la Chancho baru dagni kyab su chi, dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki, dro la penche sange dro pa shok. Well, you know, like we've been talking, like I've been saying, you know, see, hear words saying a kind heart, and it sounds very nice, but it should scare the life out of us, I tell you. Because it's actually extremely difficult. All the work, all the talk we talk about, all the heavy-duty stuff of seeing your own mind, looking at the attachment and the delusions and the anger and how it pollutes our love and all this business, this is the first step. Before you get anywhere near ability to have a genuine kind heart, this is the hard work we have to do, which is the work in our own mind, you know. The work, because what, very simply, kind heart is a very sweet way of summarizing the compassion wing, the development of love and compassion for sentient beings, you know. It's a sweet way of saying it. It sounds simple. If you heard there was a class on, you know, you think about the wisdom that realizes emptiness and there's no I and all this intense stuff and the heavy-duty philosophical stuff in Buddhist teachings, and then you heard about kind heart, that one sounds kind of simple. But it's not true. It's just not true, you know. It's just not true. And one of our biggest things, I think, in our culture, and when we think of people, we think, he's such a kind person. And we know people like this who seem, as we'd say, who seem kind of naturally kind, you know. Then there are people who just sort of, oh, God, she's so mean. And this is, part of the thing is for us, this is what the Buddha is saying about how we cling to our sense of self. We get, you know, as we know from Buddha's teachings, karma, we get born into this life, programmed from the first second of conception, with our sort of personality. You know, which is just a bunch of pieces all put together. You know, you get a person with a lot of anger, a little bit of this, very intelligent, and a small amount of pride, and a great big amount of jealousy. You have a certain shaped person. This is how we all are. But our trouble is we then define ourselves in those terms and set it in stone and think, this is who I am. Or we see someone else, we go, that's who they are. And this is very strong in our minds. The Buddhist way of saying that is that's grasping at things as inherent and permanent. But this is how we are naturally. So therefore, in our culture, it's kind of ironic. We know it's not true that you're not stuck in stone when it comes to learning to ride a bike. If you believe that you are the person you're born with, you'd never learn to ride a bike. You'd never get past crawling. You'd never get past wearing diapers. So we kind of know in our intelligent world that you can transform your mind into the most amazing, talented mind. We can learn the most unbelievable things. But it's kind of interesting when it comes to thinking we're stuck. It's in the emotions, isn't it? You see what I'm saying here? We know we're not stuck in not knowing about mathematics. We've got this enthusiasm. We have these amazing skills. We have good teachers. We go learn it and become a mathematical genius. We know we can change our mind when it comes to those things, but we don't realize we can change our mind when it comes to our emotions or the person that we are, the kind of person we are. And we are our own worst enemy here. We stay stuck in, this is who I am. So then we think of people, there's kind person, there's mean person, there's ugly person, there's intelligent person. It's true, they are characteristics, but we assume you're stuck with it. Well, what can I do? Mother Teresa, she's just born that way, you know. There's Hitler, he's just born that way. Concrete. So anyway, that part is the part that makes it so difficult for us to change, you know. So then especially when we think of kindness, we don't think that it's something you can learn to do. You're born this way. That's how we think, you know. If a person wasn't very angry, you don't think, oh, well, where's a course I can do to help me get more angry, you know. We don't think like this, because that's just who you are. But this is the biggest misconception. Of course we are. A person has a tendency towards anger, one person born this way because of past anger, and another person has a tendency to be loving, because they're kind. Even, you know, some people, you can see it the way their body is. They bend, and they've got sweetness, and their nature's kind. They're very patient, and they're always this way. But we set it in stone. That's why it's so hard. But the fact is, we can become a kind person. We can become a less angry person. Of course, this is the point. This is the fundamental point that Buddha's making. And it's much difficult. It seems easier to go and become a mathematical genius. isn't it? It's kind of ironic, isn't it? We know that part of our mind can change. We make this big distinction between that part of our mind and the emotional part. But for the Buddhist view, there's not a fraction of difference. It's just a bunch of habits, that's all. It's just a bunch of habits. And if you have confidence, you can learn math, and then you will. And if you have confidence, you can become kind, you will. It's just learning to know and to unpack it, as usual, to unpack. So what is kindness then? Well, kindness is this nice word that we use for a person who is, you know, basically that person has love for others. You could say it that way. We don't think of it like that. Love sounds very dramatic. And you have love especially for close people. You don't think of just loving a stranger. That sounds weird. Because when we say love, we mean attachment as well. But the actual meaning of love, as we said yesterday, as we know, the actual meaning of love is a positive state of mind that is expressed as the wish that someone be happy. So then that's what a kind person is. They're loving. That's where we have to really redefine the use of the word loving or love. Think of it, you know. Having a kind heart and loving people, it sounds very different to us. But it's because we have a different interpretation of love because we include attachment in the mix. And love is usually what you have for your friends and your beloveds and your children and your dearest husband, you know. Whereas kindness is something you can express to everybody. Well, that's what love is. That's what love is. Love is when a person's happy, you feel warm towards them and you're happy for them. That's what kindness is. Kindness is just an expression of loving somebody. So we have to really define our terms. It's so important. So then, you know, right now we can see with some people, like I said, the ones who we think of as just kind, we can see they can even be kind to strangers. And they're kind to even mean people. Because that means they've trained their minds, obviously from the past, Buddha would say they've come programmed into this life with less self-cherishing, less selfishness, because they've practiced this way. And therefore there's less barrier between them and others. So, you know, the thing is, too, it's important when we hear these teachings to be able to put them in the context of the bigger package. This is why these Tibetans are so brilliant in the way, especially since Atisha in the 11th century, that they've packaged all the teachings of the Buddha, all the methods and teachings in a nice orderly way in this course. So, you know yourself, if you're studying maths, you just look at a textbook and you know that that's way, you know the level it's at because you know exactly because it's all structured in a course. Well, that's the same with all the teachings. It's so important to have a sense of the structure. So if you just open a book and you find one sentence, you know exactly where it is in the course. So if you hear about karma, you know that's in junior school. If you read about knowing the mind, that's in high school. If you read about love, that's in university. You read about emptiness, that's taught in university as well, although it's a high school topic which they study in other places in high school, in the Theravadan countries. So you really need to know, and when you know this, suddenly the teachings have a lot more ground, rather than this random series, oh, a bit of love today, a bit of patience tomorrow, a bit of this, a bit of that. But they all have, you've got to know where they all fit. And that's not too complicated, you just have to learn it, that's all. Then you really can know the level of difficulty of a teaching. So love and being kind belong in the highest one. Surprising to us, because they sound so simple, you know. So what is it that prevents us from being kind? What is it that makes it easy to be kind is when you're attached to the person. You give your heart for this person. You die for them. That is kindness, but it's easy kindness. It's kindness that our attachment has a lot of vested interest in keeping. And this stuff sounds very cruel to us, but we need to see this. We need to see this in our own minds. But then what prevents us, therefore, from being kind to a person who isn't our beloved is obviously the division, this thing that separates between me and others. So if we use the bodhisattva path, the compassion wing way of talking, the obstacle is called selfishness or putting me first. If we took it the lower scope and the middle scope way of talking, attachment to what I want is the obstacle. It's just different ways of describing. So whenever you read about self-cherishing in the Buddhist teachings, that's the university way of talking. That's the bodhisattva path way of talking. You've really got to see these things. Then it makes more sense. The teachings have a deeper meaning for you. Otherwise, it's just random stuff that you're picking up here and there, you know? Are you following what I'm saying, people? If you've studied any of the teachings, you really need to know this. So as soon as we talk about kindness, good heart, blah, 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 this is all taught in the earlier stages, but the emphasis you know, is on seeing the delusions, seeing the negative states, and knowing the main delusion is ego grasping, the one that clings to the self. The main voice of the ego grasping is attachment to get what I want. Anger is the response when it doesn't, and then jealousy and arrogance and all the other variations come. This is the Buddhist model of the mind, very neatly structured, and you really get to become familiar with this in like the second scope of the teachings, in the wisdom wing. But when we're talking the compassion wing, it's a different slant. The main obstacle is not, of course attachment is talked about, but the main obstacle to our, this is the point here, to the whole development of this unbelievable levels of love and compassion, which culminate in bodhicitta, which turns us into the bodhisattva, which is then the person who combined with emptiness, becomes the Buddha. The obstacle to the one in particularly that's called exchanging self for others, this amazing radical technique that's used, that's seen as the best method among all the Tibetan tradition, coming from Shantideva in India, the most radical series of techniques to really develop powerful love and compassion, is this whole one of exchanging self for others. As we've been talking, we talked last time when we talked about bodhicitta, the radical, you know, one of exchanging self for others. So in the traditions, as you'll see in the text, there are two main traditions of techniques. One is called the 7-point cause and effect, whatever they call it, the kindness of the mother, that approach, you know. This other one, the other one is called exchanging self for others. And then the one I was talking about last week, which is a combination of 11 little techniques, is these two systems coming together. The first few are from the 7-point blah, and then the rest are from the exchanging self for others, exchanging self for others. So we'll use this as our context here, the one of exchanging self for others, which is the really dramatic, outrageous level of the development of love and compassion, the development of a kind heart, you know. It's quite extreme. So in that context, when we're aiming to literally put others ahead of self, to see others as more important, to cherish others more than self, then this is the context in which we can understand when we hear and read about self-cherishing, or as we'd call it in our culture, selfishness, putting self first. So this is a consequence of the delusion, the root delusion of ego grasping. And what, as I said, in the compassion, in the wisdom wing, the way of talking about the problem from this, it's attachment is the problem. And then here, the particular take on it is the one of self-cherishing is the problem coming from this. We put self first. Now with this, if we begin to look at our mind, it's really evident, it's really obvious. It's so primordial. It seems so natural. So natural to us to put self first. Now this is where it sounds cruel, but that's where we're, even when we are kind to our beloveds, there is a feeling of closeness there because the person looks beautiful to us, and because we have attachment for them, they look beautiful to us. So therefore it is easy to be kind towards them. It is easy to see them and to feel connected to them, feel close to them and want them to be happy and have compassion. And that's marvelous. At least it's a decent, you know, better to have love for somebody, you know. Better than punching them in the nose. At least we have some love for somebody. But our trouble is, in our culture too, we reinforce that that's the only one you're supposed to have love for. You're really a special, unusual person if you actually forgive an enemy. That's kind of seen as like a saint-like action. But this is what the Buddha says we have to learn to do. Go beyond the usual barriers, the usual assumptions we have about what we're capable of, you know. So another point too I want to say, and I'm going to go into these techniques again. The other point, of course, is that it's really, really, really important to see the advantage to ourself of being kind to others. This sounds a bit suspect to us. We think, oh, that sounds very selfish. That I shouldn't be like that. But it has to be gradual. To actually be a person who truly puts another person first, and I mean not just every now and again emotionally, but it's a stable realization. I mean, that's pretty high. You know, we have moments of it. We have moments of it. But we've got it. We're trying to develop it to a stable degree such that you are like that all the time. You've actually got the realizations of it. Well, that's really intense. So part of the process of getting there is, and this is already powerful, is to really see the advantages to myself of putting others first. As they say in these 11 techniques, one of them is to think about the disadvantages of being selfish to me and the advantages of being kind to others. It's really important, you know. I know when I first heard these teachings, I mentioned this. Excuse me. Drink my cup of water. And I need a tissue. As soon as I start to talk, everything starts going moving, isn't it? Excuse me. So, oh dear, what did I say? I lost it. Okay, yes, good, thank you. When I first heard these teachings, I remember hearing about bodhicitta, you know, and exchanging yourself for others, and sacrificing yourself for others, and seeing the others as the highest of all, and you as the lowest. It was all just like insane, you know. I really was shocked that they could talk about this stuff in such a straightforward way. Because it just seemed utterly impossible. It seemed like the actions of what you call saints. And, you know, and again, we don't have courses to become a saint. Oh, well, I want to become a saint, please. We don't talk like that. Well, the simple other word for bodhisattva is a saint. That word we know very powerfully. Well, that's what a bodhisattva is. They're a saint, basically. It's saint-like behavior. But it's not mystical, which is how we think you're born this way. It's a special gift. Buddhist techniques are to help us become like that. So, when I mentioned this last week. For me, I couldn't get a handle on this stuff. I couldn't get a way into it. I didn't know how to approach it. You know, I couldn't get a leg up onto it. You know, it was just too much for me. But then I remember hearing His Holiness the Dalai Lama say, "Do you want to help others? Practice compassion. You want to help yourself? Practice compassion." Suddenly, I found a doorway in. Because that we relate to, and that's using logic. And then it's kind of calms the mind. It sounds selfish, but I mean, we're being mean to people out of selfishness. And then the manipulative way of being kind to people, that's not what he means by that. Because that's what we do now. We're kind to people because our ego gets investment in it. That's not what's being said here. It's been said in a genuine way. And I remember Dalai Lama often always, when he talks to countries and politicians, he always talks about, well, if you know, see the advantage to you of being kind to your neighbors. If you walk around with lots of weapons and threatening lots of wars, you're not going to have many friends. It's turned into winter in here. What happened? I know that thing's very tricky, isn't it? I know it seems like very sensitive, the air conditioning. We'll just leave it warm and then we open the door. Leave it warm, then we can open the doors every now and again if we faint with heat or something. Or open the door and get the cool air in. I know, it's curious, isn't it? Okay, so right now, when we understand, you know, we are kind to some people. But then we can see very clearly, can't we, even that kindness can wear thin pretty quickly for the child. You know, who's the person we get the most mad at? Who are the 40% of, you know, the one I keep talking about, we get murdered? But the person you were initially extremely kind to. So it can turn on a dime, and that shows that it's very fragile. The ability to be kind in us now, even if it is for our beloveds, is really fragile. And why? Is because we have this intense self-cherishing, which is the consequence of ego grasping. And therefore we are attached to get what I want. The more we can understand this, then it's very sobering. And we can understand, therefore, how really difficult it is to truly have a kind heart in a stable way. You know? That's why for me, I want to keep saying this. It sounds easy, but do not believe it is. It is not. And that means a realization of it. And that's what we're not used to thinking. Like I said, we don't have courses to get a kind heart. We don't have courses to become like Mother Teresa. We think, and this is one of our biggest obstacles, I think, but like I said before, we tend to think we're born a certain way. You know? And we're stuck with it. But this is the part that's really the one that we have to understand, that we can move towards it step by step by step, practicing. And any practice of anything is hard work because it takes effort. And effort means going against the status quo. So when it's selfishness and anger and fears and dramas, then that's a pretty intense status quo to have to try and shift. That's why it sounds so easy, have a kind heart. It ain't. Stably, I'm saying. That means a kind heart for the mean person. That's when you really know you've got it. That's when you really know you're getting somewhere, when you can be kind and forgiving to the person as they're mean to you. Not later. That's better. Fine. Later. Forgive them. But as they're being mean to you, you're being kind. in your heart. You might get away, they're a bit crazy, but in your heart you see their suffering. That's what a kind heart is. You empathize with the person. That's compassion, you know. That's really what we're aiming for. And that's why, like I was saying yesterday, the test, the time to see the difference between attachment and love, for example, or attachment and liking, like the chocolate cake. It's impossible initially to notice the difference between liking chocolate cake and attached to chocolate cake. It's only when you don't get the chocolate cake. That second the carrot cake comes and you get upset. That's when you know you were attached to the chocolate cake. You don't know until you don't get what you want. The same with a person. As long as I'm loving and kind to dear Fred, I mean, as long as Fred is doing what I want, making me happy, being loving and kind to me, then love and kindness to Fred is easy. But the moment he starts not doing what my attachment wants, that's when it becomes difficult. And this is where awareness is so crucial, because that's the tipping point. It's like, you know, when you really know you're doing good at your push-ups, when your muscles are beginning to change is when it starts to hurt. Up until then, you haven't really done push-ups. There's no change. Will ever happen. You've got to hurt. And that's where making effort. And that's where we have to have awareness, because that's the practice. You see, people. So kind heart sounds great. So kind heart. It's just, you have to look into the techniques, that's all. We have to look into these simple little analytical meditations, these techniques, these things we think through in order to train ourselves. It's called, not for nothing, another term for this type of approach is called mind training. It sounds peculiar, it sounds very military. Lodong, mind training. But that's all we're trying to do. We're trying to train ourselves to become a different person. Train, that's like what you do when you do maths. You're training your mind to think differently. That's all. What's the same here? It's the same technique. Okay, so in order to understand this, it's really important to understand meditation, what it means. And I tell you, we have so many misconceptions. So if we think about doing a meditation on love, we can't even imagine what that means. We try to imagine, you know, feeling something, or we just have these ridiculous cliched ideas. So let's look at the two kinds of meditation. It's extremely important to understand this. Well, first of all, the Tibetan word for the verb to meditate. It's the verb, it's the word gom, and it's the verb to familiarize. You think about this. It's very fascinating. It really cuts through all the misconceptions we have. We're talking Buddha's view now. You can have other types of meditation. You can call it what you like. We're talking here Buddha's view. It's to familiarize. The verb to familiarize. Well, so then let's think about what that means. Let's unpack that. So, you know, so someone says, go and meditate on love, or meditate on death, or meditate on emptiness, or meditate on karma. We're initially puzzled because we have this misconception of the word meditate. We have a vague notion of still and no thoughts and peaceful, and a very vague notion. We don't really know what it means. We haven't analyzed the meaning of the word. So let's do exactly that. And it's going to be very surprising and not complicated. We do it all the time. We just don't call it that. So if the word to meditate is the verb to familiarize, then someone says, well, go and meditate on love, or go and meditate on death, let's say. Then what are they saying? Well, familiarize. Then you go, well, familiarize what with what? Well, familiarize my mind with death. Oh, that's interesting. Become familiar with death. Okay, then I'm going to take which topic I'm going to take, you know, to what I'm going to familiarize. But the point here about familiarization, we know if you're going to learn music and your teacher says, well, go home and meditate on this, please. All she's saying is, go and familiarize yourself with this piece I've just taught you, Rabina. And that means learn. That means practice it, doesn't it? So obviously when it comes to piano, there's two things. You've got to use your mind. You've got to know the notes, which is your thoughts. And you've got to have your hands. Right? So if it's mathematics, it's very straightforward. Go home and meditate on this sum that I've just told you, Rabina. She means go and familiarize my mind with it. Well, another word for that, and this is very disappointing because it's surprising, is go think about it. Would you agree that to familiarize your mind with something means to think about it? It's simple, isn't it? Well, don't think there's anything different here. So familiarize your mind with emptiness means think about emptiness. Think about death. Think about karma. Think about impermanence. Think about love. Think about compassion. So then, not just the word You don't go, compassion, 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 hoping something will come, which is how we tend to think that meditation means some vision will come, you know. So when she says go and think about your sums, go and think about one and one is two. She just taught me, my little Miss Holton at school taught me that 1 + 1 = 2. And she basically would say to me, go home now, Robina, and I want you to do the two kinds of meditation, because there's two modes, and I'll go into them. The first one is, you know, the first one, she's, go and do the two kinds of meditation. First, sit down and do some single point of concentration, get some focus, please, and then go to the second mode of meditation, which is the point, and now I want you to familiarize yourself with this so that you trigger an insight into it. This is what she would say if she was a Buddhist teacher. Are you kind of hearing my words here? She'd say, go home and do the two kinds of meditation. The first kind is get some focus. And we all know, if you're going to think about something, you better get some focus. Because you'll be all over the place. Get some focus, get some concentration to the extent that you can. Now, that's the beginning only. Now you go to the second mode of meditation. And now you're going to start, and you're going to get, they call it insight or special insight. The first one's called, okay, the first kind is called calm abiding. It's the name of the result of, called, the development of single-pointed concentration. This particular state known as calm abiding, which is actually a Hindu technique that the Buddha picked up and ran with, you know. And it's this outrageous psychological skill that we all can learn that enables you to access subtler, more refined levels of your mind. Beyond, you know, where you've gone beyond the chatting, nonsense, gross level of our being, which is the level we live at, where you can get to a subtle level that has a super powerful, super clear, super sophisticated, capable level of conceptuality at a subtler level that you can use easily. It can focus on one thing without moving, and it can be used skillfully to, on any topic you wish. This is very interesting. This subtle, incredible, capable level of mind that we never normally have. Even the best concentration we ever get, which can be pretty incredible, is still gross in comparison with this level that we are capable when we've achieved this calm abiding, as they call it. So the reason we need this calm abiding, and the reason Miss Holton says go get some focus, is so that you, when you do the real work in the second mode of meditation, which is also called, in terms of its result, which is called special insight. This is vipassana, special insight, the Sanskrit word. So that term is used a lot now, almost for a special branch of meditation that's used by a lot of people who say they're doing vipassana, you know. But in the different traditions in Buddhism, it's done in different ways. So this is the one that's done in the Mahayana, and it's a technique. The end result is this insight, special referring to insight into emptiness. But these two techniques can be used to get insight into anything. It's okay, so we can just call it insight for this reason. Special insight refers to emptiness. Insight into emptiness. So this word in English is great. Insight. Inner seeing. You get it. The penny drops. Isn't it? It's a very good word. So, Miss Holton says, go home, Robina, do some single point of concentration to the extent that you're capable, then you go to the second mode of meditation, and I want you to get some insight into this. And she just told me the sum 1 + 1 = 2. I haven't got a clue what she's talking about. I've never heard it before. But she wants me to internalize it. She wants me to get an insight into it. She wants me to know it in my heart, doesn't she? She wants me to learn it, do my homework. She wants me to understand it. So you get your focus. Then you go to the second mode of meditation. So when you're going to read in all your Tibetan Buddhist texts, that the method, they often call this second method of meditation in terms of the technique that you're using to trigger insight. Okay? And it's called analytical meditation. Well, another word for that is to think. Meditate means become familiar, right? Familiarize your mind. So in the first mode of meditation, you're familiarizing your mind with the breath. And that, in this case, it's focusing. It's focusing without thought. Focusing. You're familiarizing your mind with the object of meditation. You're familiarizing your mind with the visualization. That's the first mode, familiarization. The second one, the technique is called analytical meditation in order to trigger an insight. Hear the words. What we'd say is, we'd think about it. So you know perfectly well, if first you have some focus when you go do your homework, then you go to the second mode, and you have to have the information Miss Holton gave you. You must. You can't just be vague. Well, maybe she said 1 plus 1 is 14. I can't remember. But never mind, I'll just get some insight into it. 1 plus 1 is 14, 1 plus 1 is 14. Hoping a vision will come. And we're so ridiculous, you know, it's so superstitious. You must have the right words. So you go home, you get some focus. You go to the second mode, and now you pick up your pencil, don't you, or your little blocks or whatever you've got, and you've got the information she told you. You've got to start with a theory. 1 plus 1 is 2. And what you're trying to do is put meat on the bones. What you're trying to do is make it your own experience. What you're trying to do is understand it. We call this learning in our culture, don't we? And the method you use is to think about it. They call it in Buddhism meditation, familiarizing your mind, and the particular kind is analysis, which is a fancy word for thinking about it. Can you hear me? It's simple, isn't it? And we are geniuses at these methods. We do this every, anything we have ever learned, we have done by having focus and then studying it and familiarizing it until we get insights. That's what we, and we are geniuses at it. We're brilliant. But the moment we hear these words used in a different context, in a spiritual context, we mystify them. We haven't got a clue. People have been studying Buddhism for 30 years, say, oh, I don't know what analytical meditation is. Oh, how to do it, I don't know. Use your noggin is what it means. That's why I keep saying you've got to have the right words. It's sort of, you know, you'd be embarrassed to hear that if you went to mathematics class. It goes without saying you've got to have the right words. That's called mathematics. But in we mystify things in spiritual, shockingly. And things like love and compassion, we totally mystify. We think it's all this feeling I've got to get. You sit down and I had a special meditation this morning, I got a feeling of love. I mean, that's kind of literally like superstition. It's like thinking that practicing piano means you don't know any theory, but you have a feeling for music. You sit down and you play some things, you know, and some nice sound comes out and you suddenly get a good feeling. We to think that that means playing music, we know it's kind of childish. You've got to hear the theories. If you choose to play that kind of music, you've got to have the notes all clear. Mr. Bach says this and that, all the laws, all the rules, all the structure, all the theories clear in your head. Then you practice it. And there's no good feeling in the beginning, believe me. It's straight hard work, isn't it? But slowly, slowly, as you internalize those theories, guess what's going to happen? You'll forget, the theories will become internalized, and then you'll start accessing spontaneous music and genuine feeling of it, and that's when it's stable. Now you can say you're a musician. Well, this is exactly how you develop insight into emptiness, karma, and love and compassion as well. No difference, people. I promise you. When we understand this, then we can relax and go one step at a time. Instead of panicking, oh, I have no realizations, oh, I have love yesterday and no love today, oh, I have guilt today and no... We're up and down like yo-yos, you know, because we don't understand the techniques. And they're not complex. They just use different words, that's all. You know. I can't stress understanding this enough, I tell you. So when you say meditate on love, we think you've got to meditate on the end result, which is loving feelings. No, you meditate on the techniques to get the ways of thinking that eventually will trigger an experience of love, and then the ability to sustain it until eventually it is a genuine insight, a genuine realization. Same with karma, death, impermanence, all of Buddha's teachings, emptiness, no difference. The techniques are identical. You learn the stuff that then manifests as an experience. You just saw music first, all these weird little notes on a piece of paper, and then someone played some music over there, but you didn't know that that related to this. You'd never believe it in a million years. If you just saw a weird three eggs and two this and four cups of flour, and then you saw a cake, but you didn't know a recipe, you'd never realize that that related to this. So dry, boring theory doesn't seem to have a relationship to the end result, but when we know it does, then we're prepared to work through it, the dry, boring theory, because it will bring an insight. So when you hear the teachings on emptiness, you know, sounds so abstract. And then we hear about a person who's gone beyond ego, and they're blissful and happy and loving and wise. You hear that, and you see all these complicated theories. Again, you can't see the relationship. Same thing, though. When we know this, understand it, then conceptual clarity is an incredibly important stepping stone. I have to have conceptual clarity. The 1 + 1 = 2. I cannot do any homework if I don't know that. I'm useless. So if I don't know the words to think when I sit down to think about emptiness, then don't even waste your time. Go back to the books, please, and get the words. Even you just say the words, there is no inherent I, there is no I that doesn't exist and depends upon something. Hear that much, and you think about that much. That's a perfect meditation. You mightn't get an insight yet. Don't be impatient. But you start the ball rolling. This is how you do the two kinds of meditation. First kind, focus. Second time, think about it. And think means thoughts. And thoughts are words. It's not complicated. Are we communicating? Good. So, okay, how do we get love? How do we get a kind heart? Oh, exhausting. Go back to junior school. Control your body and speech. First one. Start looking at your mind. Second one. Then start doing these other techniques, you know, equanimity and all the others. I have to talk about these. These are the techniques, you know. There's no point just raving on about what a kind person's like. It's not helpful. It's like raving on about a cake all day thinking you got a class in cooking. You didn't. People just rave on about how nice cakes are. What good is that? So, you know, kind hearts difficult. I'm talking too much about kind hearts. So let's talk about the techniques of how to get it. So do you have any questions first about what I've just said? This meditation business, I mentioned it just briefly. Do you have anything to say first before we go into the techniques of how to get a kind heart?
Venerable Rabina, I have a question. I'm a high school teacher.
Yep.
And when I'm teaching kids how to think, I often have them write to think. And what I'm wondering is, for stage two, can writing be a way to do analytical meditation?
Any technique that we can use to help us become familiar with some theories, then do it, you know. But eventually the classic way of teaching these two is obviously at a more advanced stage, because the single-pointed concentration one demands that you close your eyes and eventually go beyond even the gross chatting. So that's when it's really deeply inside you and you've memorized the teachings and you know about it. That's a more sophisticated one. So in the beginning stages, any one of us, any methods at all that we can use to help us trigger the insight into something, fantastic.
So it could be used like a bridge to get...
Oh, of course, absolutely. Every one of us, according to our own capacity. The crucial thing is to understand that the process we're trying to go through, you know, which is why I keep linking the ordinary learning, because it's really the same as that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Here, sweetheart.
Good morning.
Hello there.
So my question is, if you start out with a single point concentration, which is hard enough,
because
I'm a very poor meditator,
and
you go on to an analytical meditation, maybe towards the end of your meditation, how much time would you spend approximately? Towards that analytical, like,
it's up to you. You know, if you had your mathematics to learn, if you had your music to learn, you know yourself how much you can cope with, how much you can handle, how exhausted you are, how much more you've got to go. It's up to you. It's up to knowing how much you want to do, how far your thinking goes. If you know, if you first learn the music and she's giving you one little simple C major scale, you know, in the very first time you play it, there's no way you're going to sit there until you've perfected it. You'll die of exhaustion. But you take it, you know. And also the other point is this. When we know ourselves enough, we know, like I said with the push-ups, you do them and you don't just stop before it hurts, because nothing will change. The same with this. You've got to make an effort. And this is the one about going against laziness. Were you here for the laziness talk?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the laziness is our biggest problem. The first kind, we need enthusiastic perseverance. We need to make effort. This is a very practical thing, because we can see if you learn anything, you've got to stretch yourself, don't you? Stretch, it's by definition stretching, isn't it? So then so the first level of laziness is like, oh, I can't be bothered. So if you stop as soon as it feels like because it's too much effort, you won't actually get it. And that's, most of us don't make enough effort with the Dharma. That's why 30 years later someone says, oh, I don't understand about emptiness. Thinking is going to come as a vision. They just haven't made the effort to think about it properly. I'm not being horrible about it. Do you understand my point? So you've got to make effort. But even a little bit of effort, 3 more prostrations, push-ups, pretty good. The next level of laziness is more tricky. oh, I'll do it later. I can't be bothered doing it. That's really lying. And the third one is, oh, my God, I can't do this. And that's why we, 30 years later, say, I don't understand it, just because we really believe we can't do it. So you take it at your own pace. You know your own mind enough. You think of it. And also, if you go through something and think about it, you know, like the very first time you think about 1 plus 1 is 2, maybe it means you can memorize it. Before you couldn't see, you had to look at the words, 1 plus, what was that, 2? Oh, equal. Oh, yeah. But now it means you've memorized it. That's a good meditation. The next step, you've got it internally, intellectual, now you go a bit deeper. And then one day you'll get your first moment of insight. Okay, with emptiness, we have to wait a lot longer. The same process. Your own boss here. And you'll know if there's been a result in your own meditation. Maybe there's no result. Maybe you're feeling more confused. Because it brings up a whole bunch more stuff. That's okay. You did a good job. You made effort. Stop. And then go to the next step. We've got to be our own boss, you know. Do you understand? Okay. So when we understand that a kind heart is really roughly speaking, it would mean a person has love. They've got an experience of loving somebody, which I said is a different way than we think. Don't think it the way we think. It means being happy for the person. Being happy for the person. That's what love is. Being happy for the person. That's all. Wanting them to be happy, and if you see them happy, being happy for them. Or if they're not happy, wanting them to be happy. So if you see a person, you know, a sad person, a person who's got some kindness there, which means love, they'd reach out. So they're thinking, oh, look at that person. That's compassion. They see them sad, and they empathize with their suffering. That's called compassion. Then they think, oh, it all happens so quickly if this is natural in them. Oh, what can I do to help? So you reach across, and you say, hello, how are you, sweetheart? You're looking lovely today. That is... There's love there, a wish to make them happy. There's compassion, which is a seed you don't want them to suffer. And not only that, you've got great compassion, which says, what can I do? You don't just say, oh, aren't they sad, and walk away. Aren't they sad, and you reach out. That's an action of great compassion. So when you understand these little things that we take for granted in life, but give them labels according to this system, which is the one we're trying to practice, it has meaning to us, you know? We're putting it into the structure. It's important. Are you with me, people? So love and compassion are the two components of a kind heart, really. Kind heart's another term for a person who's got love and compassion. These are the essence of all the good qualities. They're summarized, even into the one called compassion. That's the essence. Love is even subsumed in that, if you think about it, you know. But love is technically, like I said, wanting a person to be happy. And, and if they're not happy, wanting them to be happy. And if they are happy, delighting in it. Compassion is you see them, you want them not to suffer. And when you see them suffering, you wish they didn't suffer. And then the next step in both is where you do something to make it happen. That's the special, unique one. It's very important to understand these simple points, you know. Then it gives meaning to the words. So, of course, we are trying to develop a good heart. We're trying to develop love and compassion. So as we know in these techniques, coming back from Atisha in the 11th century, tracking back to his lama, Salimpa in Indonesia, tracking back to Shantideva in the 8th century, this famous Mahayana yogi, saint, bodhisattva, scholar in the Nalanda Monastery, whose texts are still studied in all the monasteries as part of the lineages of these practices, tracking right back, you know. So we can't help again but to talk about the techniques of how to get the kind heart. I'll just present them in the typical way we talked last week. I'm going to repeat them all again. Then we'll talk about a different perspective. But again, we'll see the traditional way it's taught. Then once you get the idea, then you can turn it into your own language. You know, once you get the idea. But keep remembering, too, these stages, these little 11 little techniques. On the face of it, one sentence can describe each technique. They sound so simple. But to actually accomplish it, each stage is not. And this is where we have to not just gloss it over and think it sounds all nice and cute, you know. So the first one, like we've been discussing, and, you know, this is the one of equanimity. And even this takes time. We had the discussion, you know, last time, wasn't it, Diane? We had this discussion, exactly what is equanimity. We hear the word, we hear the descriptions, you know, but we've got to get super clear precisely what is equanimity. What's the definition of it? You've got to know what we're talking about. You can't be vague and think a cup is a clock. What did you say it was again, a cup, clock? No, you've got to define it, like math. You can't just say 1 and 1 is 3 and think you're quite nearly, oh, I was nearly right. It won't work. I'm sorry. It could be precise. That again surprises us, to be thinking to be precise about love and compassion. It sounds the opposite to us. So the groundwork, the foundation, the basis, the root, the foundation in the series of little 11 techniques, the 11th one is the culmination is bodhicitta. Love and compassion come before that. Kind heart come well before that. You're gradually growing the kind heart, you know. The ultimate kind heart is bodhicitta. Then the absolute kind heart, of course, is the Buddha. He's removing stages and stages of neuroses, you know. So equanimity is literally the foundation upon which we are attempting to develop love and compassion, which culminate in bodhicitta. And of course it means love and compassion for every single sentient being. That's the part that's shocking. That's the part that's insane for everybody. Then of course, as we know, the very convenient and wonderful way to divide the universe, all the sentient beings of the universe, to divide the sentient beings of the universe into categories. There's three categories, and they're related to the three root delusions, which you learned about in high school. The root delusion is called ignorance, okay? Primordial ego-grasping, the colloquial term for ignorance, or marigpa in Tibetan. The ignorance about how I and everything else actually exist. This is the root delusion, the cause of all suffering, period. There's other aspects of ignorance. There's another ignorance they talk about from as well, ignorance of cause and effect, which is a huge one of why we all suffer. And then there's just the general consequence of ignorance, which is indifference. So if we turn the object of attachment, and then the two main delusions as a result of ignorance, this is high school talking, two main delusions are attachment to get what that ego wants, and then aversion and anger when it doesn't. So ignorance, attachment, aversion. When you study the 51 mental factors, the text about the mind, you know, we discussed this, they're the grouping of three root delusions. There's also called six, there's three, there's different ones. So these are the three main delusions. So if we look at the objects of these in terms of an object meaning the object of that state of mind, in people, in terms of sentient beings, you've got three. It's very obvious. Objects of attachment, we call friends. Objects of aversion or anger, we call them enemies. Object of indifference, which is a consequence of this primordial ignorance, is a stranger. It's very profound, yet very simple. It really puts, Buddhist psychology into focus right here in terms of the development of love and compassion. We have friends, we have enemies, and we have strangers. There's no fourth category when you think of it in these terms. And we look at the world, and this is really easy to prove. We have our people, and they're the ones who do what my attachment wants. And they're the ones for whom I do have love. No question, we do have love. We want them to be happy. Then we have those who don't do what my attachment wants, who hurt me, harm me, or hurt my people, you know, and very mild levels. Come on, grab a chair. Oh, she's okay. You right? Okay, so then we have, you know, we see we are friends, enemies, and strangers, you know. We have people who are our people. And that's a different way to be categorized. It can be, you know, our poodles. We might like poodles as opposed to Alsatians. So our poodles go into the friends category, you know. And our children maybe, and our beloveds, whatever they are, our friends. Friends is a broad category for those who are the objects of our attachment, for whom we do have love. At least this. Then we've got those who don't do, and enemy sounds a dramatic term, but it's a good term for the object of aversion, the opposite to a friend. Friends and enemies, you know. We might use that word so strongly, but get the meaning here. The person who annoys us, irritates us, upsets us, mean to us at work, who looks ugly to us, whom we don't want to be happy, whom we don't have compassion for, unless we work hard, which is what we're trying to do here. That's the enemy. Everybody's got some of them. Automatically. We fall into these three immediately. Anybody, you go to work within a week, you've divided them into friends, enemies, and strangers. The group, like in one day even, if you start to have a bit of interaction with each other in this room, you're going to have friends, enemies, and strangers. And in a week's time, you'll remember only two groups, the friends and enemies. You will not remember any strangers. You'll remember Fred and Mary. One you hated, one you adored. The rest, who was that? Oh, were they up the course, were they? Because they're the stranger. You don't remember strangers. It's just how we are. And it seems so obvious, but it's sort of a revelation when you understand it, you know? And the three root delusions. So, the first meditation in building up, step by baby step, this development of love and compassion for all sentient beings, is the first one is to have developed this thing they call, it's just called equanimity. I mean, it's just a label that's been used in the tradition, so we better know the definition of it, because it's a very typical English word. Look up your dictionary, it's going to have a very different definition, like flat, you know, B flat in music, flat that you live in London, where they usually call them apartments now, but it used to be called a flat. You live in a flat, and there's a flat table. Same word, different definition. So here, equanimity, simple word. What's the definition? Well, when you've got it, when you've accomplished it, what it will be is this. Simple. It will be this heartfelt, meaning it will be spontaneous when you've got it. When you've got it. All we do is practice getting it at the moment. But when you've got it, which is pretty sublime already, and that's the first of the 11, when you've got it, it will be a heartfelt, spontaneous, knowing, recognition that enemy, friend and stranger, that the three people out there, enemy, friend and stranger, object of attachment, aversion, ignorance, that these three people are the same from their point of view, the same as each other from one point of view. They wish to be happy and not suffer. That's it. Technically, that's equanimity. They are the same as each other from the point of view of wanting to be happy and not wanting to suffer. Now, right now, they are not the same from my point of view, which is the point of view we only know, isn't it? Enemies are horrible, mean people. Friends are divine, gorgeous people. And strangers, just boring. Isn't it? Would you agree? So we only can see it from our point of view. We can't even conceive of, as our mothers would say, put them yourself in their shoes. This is an amazing point. This is a point that, and all that's being said in all these stages of development, getting into love and compassion and a kind heart, is the main obstacle is self-centeredness. It's such a simple concept. The main obstacle is we see everything just naturally from our own perspective. We can't even imagine doing anything different. It just seems weird to us. And we can see on this earth. We can see the people. Forget yourself. Look at others. The extent to which they suffer. Taking this as our perspective is the extent to which they're self-centered. It's obvious. It's another take on it. It's from attachment and anger and jealousy point of view, it's a different take, different way of talking in the wisdom wing, you know. But here, we can see. And this is such a simple concept, but so outrageous already. So remember, we're not trying to develop love and compassion here. This is the first. Love and compassion come in the way it's structured about 7 points on when you do Tonglen, that marvelous technique, you know, which we'll talk about. So the very first one, and already this is incredible. If we're capable of applying this a few times in our daily life, already the result in our mind is incredible. So the essential thing you're doing here, the starting point, in all of these we're attempting to do this, is get ourselves out of the equation. And just, we're talking theory first, beginning to practice it first, to understand theoretically this first. And it's so profound. So how you meditate on this, as we discussed the meaning of the word meditate, to how you familiarize your mind with this, in each of these techniques you're just using visualization, you're imagining. So here we imagine in front of us an enemy, to the front, eyeball to eyeball, to the left in front a friend, and to the right in front a stranger. Each, as we're talking, we can all put our three people right there. And all you're doing in these techniques is using logical arguments to argue with ego's entrenched, ridiculous misconceptions. That's all. You're trying to be reasonable with yourself. You're using reasoning. This is what you're doing. This is what this kind of meditation is. You're thinking things through in a very clear, rational way. Because if we look at emotion, negative emotions, deluded emotions, freaking out, angry, hurt, jealous, resentful, there's not a fraction of logic there. Well, ego's got its own logic, and it ain't logic. But it upholds its position violently. So we have to argue with that, these violent positions of this sense of righteousness that I'm allowed to see this person as angry, as horrible, therefore this, therefore that, therefore this, you know. In other words, we've got to unpack
all the assumptions we have now based upon attachment, aversion, and ignorance. You know? Here, with the glasses. Yep.
My question is regarding compassion. And compassion for the stranger or the enemy versus for our loved ones. Compassion can be easier at times for an enemy or a stranger because of the lack of attachment.
That's right, exactly.
That you have for
them.
That's
right, exactly.
Versus
yes.
The compassion for a loved one. The attachment you hold makes you suffer.
That's right, exactly.
So what is the remedy?
Well, that's all these things we're talking about is the remedy. Just working on our minds, seeing this, and going slowly, slowly in this structured, organized way. This is the ideal way it's taught. We do each of these steps, one step at a time. And this is why the teaching on equanimity is so powerful. You've heard this stuff before?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, good. So just keep listening. And this is why... It's sort of what we're doing here is I'm beginning to describe, say, in this section, the first step. And then what you're talking about is some experience four steps on where you notice a certain thing. So what to do about it? Well, you've got to get the first step first and then the second. And this is what we're not used to thinking when it comes to love and compassion. We just think of it as random moments of certain experiences. We're not very analytical about it. You see what I'm saying here? So by understanding what equanimity is and trying to get it, then understanding the next one, you'll be able to answer the question yourself when you get to see what the problem is. In a sense, you've answered it yourself because the presence of attachment is the problem. And that's answered in junior school. Are you seeing what I'm sort of saying? The approach, you know?
Yes.
The more we understand technically the structure of these teachings as methods to accomplish these realizations, the more we can, like you said, if you're playing the piano, you'll know what the problem is because you've got the theories. Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So equanimity. Equanimity. Where is everybody? People have gone, disappeared. Where's Dion? She's not here. Okay. I see. Okay. I see. Okay, good. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. So, equanimity, this simple word, is defined very precisely here as when you get it, you know, once you've got it, we've got to practice getting it, we've got to go towards getting it, is when you have got it, even a moment of it, you know, even intellectually, is already fantastic, is when you recognize that these three people, an enemy and a friend and a stranger, which from the point of view of ego, which is the natural perspective we use, from their point of view, are completely the same in wanting to be happy and wanting not to suffer. It's a simple, simple, not complicated concept. So what we're trying to do, all we're trying to accomplish in this practice of equanimity is come to that conclusion. The conclusion of the meditation would be, to the degree that you've got it, okay, they're all equal. They want to be happy. There's no difference. It sounds so simple, but it's beyond outrageous. Of course it is. So when you have to use lots of different arguments to counteract ego's very entrenched misconceptions. And the misconception mainly is that they're different, and I love my friend, I hate my enemy, and I couldn't care less about my stranger. That's the status quo now of ego, isn't it? That's how we are deeply and spontaneously. It's so deep inside us. So I use that example, you know. I remember I looked at my iPad on the New York Times. You go to the stories, and on the right-hand corner down here, I notice out of the corner of my eye a story that said 360 people die in ferry accident in Tasmania. Remember? Well, Tasmania is my people. It's one of the states of Australia. So I went, oh. Then I noticed it said Tanzania. And then I went, oh, so it's okay. It was all in a millisecond. Now you understand. Because it's just deep inside us. It's all, theoretically, we understand equanimity. We're all trying to be good Buddhists. But it was so spontaneous. It proves that even just this first one, equanimity, forget about genuine love and compassion, that's stable, it's still deep in our bones. As long as there's ego grasping, as long as there's attachment, it's very powerful inside us. Straight away, it didn't matter so much because they're strangers. So, of course, I opened it and read it and tried to have compassion, you know. It's very powerful. So simple. And it's spontaneous. You instantly recognize and run to a friend. You instantly recognize and move away from the enemy. And you don't even notice the stranger. It's so deep inside us. So this first step, don't underestimate it. To begin to see the logic of how they're equal from their point of view. So one of the first things, the way to say it is, what you're doing is getting yourself out of the equation. Because this is the point that they're saying in Buddhist psychology, of course, and we're seeing it so obvious, that we see everything and everybody in our life just spontaneously through the filter of our own needs. It's so clear. What is a friend? Is it by definition a person who will do what I want? It's not being horrible. It's how we are. And necessarily, even a person that's slightly threatening will instantly go away, you know, have aversion. No, they don't suit my needs. Do you see my point? And they're a stranger. They do neither. They neither harm nor help me. So we don't even notice them. Just the nature of even grabbing hold of a person with your eyes is going to either be attachment or aversion. And all the rest just slide away into indifference. It seems so obvious, but the more we think of it simply, it's kind of outrageous, you know. It shows how just naturally everyone is self-centered. Naturally. Now then we get confused, because then we think about a person who's in a relationship and who's the victim in a relationship and has a bully husband, let's say, and they're mean, they're abused, they're harmed. We would not think that person is self-centered. Wrong. They're suffering because they are self-centered. And because there's so much fear in their mind, and fear is a function of ego grasping, that they're totally yearning to have people love them and be kind to them, and they're completely terrorized and don't have any power in their own mind to make any choices whatsoever, and that's the victim mind, and that's the mind that blames as well. We only can suffer, Buddha says, if we have delusions in the mind. Doesn't mean the person's right in doing what they're doing. Doesn't mean you blame the person themselves. It's just understanding the psychology of it, you know. So equanimity, you use lots of different arguments. To get equanimity, you have to use different logical arguments to lessen the grip of the belief in the difference of the three. And the conclusion we're trying to come to is that we want to see that they're equal in their wish to be happy. This is already outrageous. So wish to be happy is the definition of love, isn't it? So it's the foundation of growing on top of it, eventually, love and compassion. Each of the techniques leads to the development of love and compassion, which is what Tonglen is. Each little incremental step on the way, each one, you build on top of the next, then you're ready to actually get love and compassion, you know. But the first step is we've got to see that they're all equal, because, and this is the logic of it. Right now, the logic that ego uses for why I want someone to be happy, that is love them, is because they do what my attachment wants. So simple. Sounds cruel and clinical, but it's just the way ego is. And the logic we use for not wanting a person to be happy, even wanting them to suffer, which is what we have for enemies, that is to say, the logic we use for not loving an enemy, is because they don't do what my attachment wants. This is the default logic of samsara. It's the way the universe works. And this is what Buddha is saying, it's in the nature of suffering. So another way of putting this, it's so outrageous, is Buddha sort of saying, well, excuse me, Rabina, just because Mary is kind to you, is no logical reason to want her to be happy. It's not a logical reason for wanting to love her. We think this is insane, because it's the only logical reason we have for loving somebody is because they love me. Do you understand? And in a sense, he's saying that's not the right reason, Rabina. It's a wrong reason. It's not a logical reason. It's a mistaken reason. It's a samsaric reason. It's a shock to us. Even worse, like what he's saying is that there's no logical reason, Rabina, for not wanting Fred to be happy that he doesn't do what you want just because he harms you. Just because Fred harms you, Rabina, that's no logical reason not to love him. I mean, excuse me, it's completely instant. It's madness. This is effectively what he's saying. So we're trying to really make this shift here, a paradigm shift in the very basis of the way we see people. In this one, this is just ground level. First one, equanimity. Changing our assumptions. So that the logic we're using here is to see that there's a real human being there. And this is why, even just in an emotional sense, if you just look at if you think of the enemy right now, whoever it is you don't like, who irritates you, makes you crazy, who annoys you, who sacked you, who divorced you, who even brutally harmed you, or one of your close people. Yes, Buddha would agree what they did was not cool. Yes, they might be a psycho. That's not the discussion here. You know, we tend to think, well, if a person's worthy of kindness and love, they have to be a nice person. That seems to be a default for us. We're even prepared to love strangers as long as they're nice people. Do you understand my point? It's not the point here. It's not even the issue, even as you're pointing out. What's your name, darling? Laura's point is even almost can be sometimes easier to have compassion for an enemy when you see how much they're suffering. Which is the point, of course. But it's, the point here is, which one way of saying it, I think, if I think of a person now who you don't like, you know, who's hurt you, even mildly, you just have to think, you know, now, as we're doing this, think, you know, she's a real human being. There's a real human being in there with a little beating heart, just like me, just like my friend. This is the point, you know. They're just like my friend, they've got a little beating heart. They don't want to get sick. They want people to love them. They don't want to suffer. You know, they want to be happy. They want to be happy. What Buddha's one of his starting point for everything is that all sentient beings want to be happy. I mean, like, duh, you know. So we're trying to prove, not get a feeling yet. Don't worry about a feeling. We're trying to prove it's true. Hear this. When you can prove it's true, you know that ego has no wiggle room. Because we think ego's true. But I'm right in hating him. He harmed me. And this is the simple logic on this earth. No one would argue with you. People would uphold your right to be angry. But all Buddha's saying is, this is not the issue here. He did harm you. We understand that. But you remember, you've in junior school you've learned about karma, so you know why he harmed you. You're already becoming accountable. And now we have to see that he's a human. Just think of that, with a little beating heart, just like your friend. Then you argue even more with ego, and you remember that when Fred was your best friend, he was under the friend category a year ago. And then you really got egg on your face. Your ego is completely embarrassed. You see my point? He was no different then. You knew then he wanted to be happy. Absolutely, you've no doubt in your mind, you knew he wanted to be happy, and you were happy to make him happy because he was making you happy. But now suddenly, you have to see how absurd it is to think that he suddenly stopped wanting to be happy because he's suddenly mean to you. I mean, the reason he was mean to you was because he wants to be happy. That's logical. Why he left you for a younger version is because he wanted to be happy. He'd think he'd be happier with her than you. That's logical. Just we can't stand to hear it. He left you because he wants to be happy. I mean, it's too brutal for us, but this is a logical fact. Are you seeing what I'm saying? You've got to be very logical. It's not emotional wishy-washy rubbish. Ego's wishy-washy rubbish. Holding on to its own pretend truth, you know. Wisdom inside us has to argue with it. It's very scary. You've got to be very direct with yourself. Okay, we've all got different methods, okay? Maybe you guys can be more gentle with yourself. Depends on how your mind works. Huh? What happened? Oh, they're having a conversation, that's okay. So you can use lots of little arguments to see, or we're trying to get to, remember the conclusion we're trying to get to, is that this friend and this enemy, which appears so absolute opposite to us at the moment, from their point of view, are not different. In the wish to be happy. They're different in terms of being psychos and kind. Yes, maybe. Fred is a psycho, maybe. He's a monster, maybe. That's not the issue here. That's not the issue here, which is a massive one for us. Because we think a person has to deserve my love. That's how we think. Well, they do deserve it, Buddha says. Because why? Because they want to be happy. They're just the same as your friend. They want to be happy. And 1 minute they're kind to you, the next minute they're not. So, you know, it's just absurd to change your view. They still want to be happy whether they like you or not. That's clear. You can really accept that logic of that one. And then strange are the same. But we don't even notice them because they haven't touched us either way. They've neither harmed nor helped us. Therefore, they completely don't even exist for our eyes. You kind of glaze over them looking for a friend, you know. And that's 99.99999% of the universe. They could all drop dead as long as they don't upset my equilibrium, you know. So equanimity is the first step in this next level of practice that then we build on to get to love and compassion. So you can see how outrageous it is already. Buddha's not asking us in these techniques, we're not supposed to love the person yet. We can if you want to. Try. But we've got to build up the logic to get to where inexorably will lead to the natural conclusion of therefore I want them to be happy and it's my job to make them happy. Equally. Equally. All of them. Everyone. So when we get confused, yes. Microphone. Go, go. Yes, it's good for everybody to hear.
Are you saying we don't have to like them, but we do? Are you saying we don't have to like them? Are you saying we don't have to like them, but we do have to love them?
Okay, so let's analyze that, shall we? Why don't you give me your definition of like? We need to understand our words. It's a good one too. So, meaning like, meaning, what do you think it means?
Meaning I can hang out with them. Meaning.
Oh no, no, that's different. Good. Now let's use a better word for it. This is a perfect point. Now I get your point. This is perfect. I forget your name.
Jim Davis.
Jim, thank you, Jim. So listen to this. I was about to get to that point, but I'll use different words. So right now. The way Buddha's saying is, we have, you know, all this karma. We sort of have history with sentient beings. So we jump into this life. We have this mummy, this daddy, these sisters, these siblings, these guys at school. You understand? We gradually develop all our friends, enemies, and strangers. But we've got this strong history with them, let's just say, from the past. So, here we are in this meditation, in this view we're trying to accomplish. I'm trying to observe logically, separate from me, these three people. There's Fred, who I was married to, who now I'm divorced from. And there's Mary, my dearest best friend. And here's Joe over here, a stranger whom I met on the bus just once. So when we hear about equanimity, and this is what you're leading to, it's a good point, we then assume, well, that means I might as well go live with Fred again, or I might as well go live with Joe. No, you see, the fact is, I've got some work to do with Mary at the moment. We've got a history with each other. We're friends. We go to work every day. We talk. We're friends. Keep sticking to Mary. Avoid Fred. It's all over. It's finished. I'll meet him again next life, whatever. But there's no more work to do with Fred. There's no reason to be around Fred anymore. It's not even, if he is a psycho, even keep distant from him, Jim, because he's a wacko. And you've got to be intelligent. You understand my point? Yeah. So it doesn't mean, of course, this equanimity doesn't mean you go, oh, well, they're all the same, in a silly sense. They're all the same from the point of view of wanting to be happy. So in my heart every day when I remember Fred, that, you know, I will really know he wants to be happy, even though the man's a wacko and they've got to put him in prison. But I'll leave him alone, thank you. And I'll go back to Mary, my beloved friend, and we'll live together and be happy and be good sisters and whatever we're going to do, because I've got some work to do, and I might never meet Joe again. But in my heart, when I remember Joe, I know he's the same as both of them. So you understand my point? Of course, keep away from the enemies. But in the heart, he's the same as everybody. He wants to be happy. And that's what gradually, already even as we say this, our heart is opening to Fred. Our heart is empathizing with their pain, beginning to want them to be happy, although we're not really getting there yet. So it's already so profound just to open our mind to seeing that they're the same as the friend. They want to be happy. But leave them in peace. Yep, for sure. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah. So in other words, we have got some history with Mary, and of course there's attachment there, so I'm going to work on my attachment and not get too excited, because she might turn into the enemy one day as well. We know this happens. So then it reinforces our wish to calm down the neuroses and have the relationship, but from a more genuine perspective, you know, from love point of view, and more detached, less grasping and needy, and then keep distant from the enemy because it's too crazy to be around him. That's perfectly fine. That's intelligence. Yeah. Yeah.
So what if we have somebody that we're trying to develop compassion and they do stuff and it shows me where my attachment is? And so I like being around them because it brings up my neurotic
tendencies.
I can see them clearly.
Cool. Yeah, that's
okay. And
then
I can see it's all in my mind. It's not them that's causing my pain.
No, of course. Nothing, there's nothing wrong. Another kind of enemy could be that.
Yeah.
It depends. I'll just give you an extreme example. We don't have to stick around the enemy, but it's all a question of our capability also. I mean, bodhisattvas would rather be around people who don't like them than those who do. Because for them, it's all practice. And even if you were to see, I mean, a bodhisattva might even, as their practice, choose to go live and marry somebody that they don't even have much feeling for and who is really mean and ugly. They would do that, and if you saw them, they would look like they genuinely love this person, because they do genuinely love this person, but not for the usual reasons that we love a person, which is a bit shocking. So it's all a question about our capability. Of course it is. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Be realistic.
Thank you. I'm Susie, by the way.
Susie, yes.
I have like a continuum when I do the equanimity meditation. So if I'm feeling particularly skillful, I can choose an enemy that is that I really have bad feelings for. And if I'm not, I can choose someone a little further along the continuum, heading towards stranger. You know
so what's
I mean?
The point here? Why
so,
are you saying this?
So
Susie?
Some are harder to do for me than others.
That's perfectly fine, darling. We've got to do what we're capable of.
Okay. So you work your way.
Of course,
through.
Sweetheart. I mean, if your husband just abused you after 20 years and then left you and then accused you of something wrong, it's a bit too raw, maybe. So choose the previous husband.
Also, is this...
you've got to know where you're at. It's like how long you meditate. We've got to know where we're at and what we're capable of. Like, if you have to lift weights, you've got to know what you can lift.
Mm-hmm.
You just got to know your capability, and you be reasonable with yourself. Of course.
Can you put ants and things on this
Of course,
continuum?
All sentient beings.
Right. Okay.
My God, yes, of course. Of course. I mean, then you'll be kind to the ants if you see that they want to be happy just like your beloved. Definitely. That's right. That's right. Any more questions? Yes. Yes, Jim.
Okay, yeah, my name's Paul.
Paul, yes.
I kind of felt this gentleman over here is talking about is that...
Which gentleman?
Contact with your enemies, right? Or
yes.
People who
yes.
don't like. That
yeah.
brings out your enemy, really. You know, your sense of self.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can study emptiness all week, right?
Uh-huh.
But you never really see what you're getting rid of.
Uh-huh.
But you get mad at somebody.
Uh-huh.
It's right there, but you kind of look at it subtly, you know? I mean, but it's there.
Uh-huh.
And instead of, or actually something really good happens to you, comes up too, right?
That's right, exactly.
But that's where your inner enemy comes up. And so if you're never angry at anybody,
uh-huh.
or you're never given cause for anger or
uh-huh.
joy...
Uh-huh.
You're never going to see what you're trying to get rid of.
I see, Paul, yes. That's a good point. Thank you. That's a good point. So what else, folks? Yeah, go down. So I think if we just do no more than just equanimity of this entire day today, we will conquer quite a lot, I think. Just let's talk about it. Go down.
Just listening to you describe
yes.
about the bodhisattvas, and I'm not that. But I was thinking... I have this just completely uncontrived, spontaneous love for the young child.
Uh-huh.
Would do whatever is needed. It's always there
uh-huh.
in my mind. You know, what can I? What does
okay.
this child want? What
okay.
you know? Always
yes.
thinking of
yes.
making their day just
right.
a good day.
Yep.
And they're not always pleasant.
No, exactly.
But it doesn't move me. It doesn't shape
okay.
how I deal with them.
I understand.
Now, here's
yes.
the thing.
Yes.
If I could take that
uh-huh.
and transfer it to adults.
That's right, exactly.
But they don't act right. No, but that would
but
be
you know
awesome
that's not,
if
but,
I could,
but
if
you
I
know
could
that's
feel
not,
the same
but,
way.
So you know that's not the logical reason, isn't it? I mean, we just have to understand the logic of this. You know perfectly
yeah.
well what's behind that is our own
yeah.
hurt, our own sense of self, our own injury, our own neediness to be approved of, our own all the other nonsense. Join the club, dear. Nothing special. So we have to know where we're at and take it according to our ability. So if we're not ready to go out there and be around abusive, horrible people and use it as grist for the mill to develop bodhicitta, we keep away from them. This is my point here about the enemy. If we're that capable,
mm-hmm.
we have to know where we're at, you know, and
yeah.
be realistic and not guilty about it.
But
it's reasonable.
But if I'm capable of doing that with them,
but
then
I'm
capable of doing that
well,
with
of course you
everybody.
Are. Yeah, but the thing is, though, we have to, the main thing, just using your example and just speaking of it as a general thing, not being too personal about you, it's because there's some reason in your life, like a lot of us, there's a lot of attachment to a child. That's why it's easy at the moment. Because like you have an ability, for whatever reason, to have a connection with a person who's a child. It's like a person who's attached to poodles as opposed to another dog. But any poodle they just adore. That's because it's an attachment there. Some people can't stand children, but they're really attached to sort of tall people. Your particular one is something horrible, because if it weren't attachment, then you could do it with adults. So as long as we know you've got a particular connection, because you're a teacher and you've got a particular role with certain human beings who are called young people, and that's your job, that's your role, that's what you do, and you're successful at it, you're good at it, so it gives you enormous encouragement. It's just like if you were a basketball teacher, you'd love all basketballers, you'd see everybody, but if they're a little squirt who couldn't throw a ball, you wouldn't care less about them. So it's your particular trip is children. Well, at least you've got some trip. But remember, if there were no attachment, you'd love them even more, and you'd love the adults equally. So it's because of attachment. That's all. That's the simple logic. Join the club, Dion. It's called Samsara. Oh, I'm falling here. What's happened? No, I'm okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I have a friend of mine that helps my next-door neighbor. And she's been helping her for years. And what's happening in the relationship is, even though the person that lives across from me is very abusive to this person that's helping them,
uh-huh.
she still stays in the relationship. So I guess my question is she teaching her it's okay to be abusive by continuing to stay in this relationship, or...
Yeah, I understand. There's two things going on. What's your name?
Chuck.
Chuck. There's two things, Chuck. First, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, compassion, which is the point actually of everything, but compassion is not enough. You've got to have wisdom. Which is, compassion is the wish to help another, but the ability to help them is not coming from compassion, that's coming from wisdom, which is to know the nuts and bolts of what they need and how to do it and what's best for them.
So,
that's a
so
tough
like
one.
Skillful means.
It's another way to put it. So the point is with your friend, I don't know where your friend is at, is your friend upset by the person being abusive? Do they get offended and hurt by it? They feel enslaved by this person? She's resentful
actually,
and all this?
She does amazingly well with it. And,
but does
and,
she?
And
she
doesn't
thinking,
take it personal.
Okay, so what's her reason, do you think, for helping the neighbor? Do you know? Does she say?
Well, because everybody else has kind of abandoned her.
Okay.
Because she's so abusive to everybody.
So is she feeling guilty and feels she can't give her up, or she just does it because she genuinely wants to help?
I think she genuinely
to,
wants to help.
She just, and she's happy to help.
Yes, absolutely.
She doesn't mind this person's abusing.
Right.
Okay,
well,
then.
She now gets to a point, you know, if she's abusive, right when she gets there, she'll just turn around and leave. You know, she walks in the door and she's screaming at her. She'll say, okay, we're not going to get anywhere today, and then leave the relationship right then and come back when they can talk a little more civilly. And that has seemed to work a little bit.
So her reason for walking out when the woman is abusive is for the woman's sake or her own sake? Everything's how you see it.
Right.
You know, if she is being a skill... I mean, the very fact that anyone continues to help an abusive person, you've got to give them a few ticks there.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt about it.
Right.
And she keeps coming back. Fine. She's not a Buddha yet, so therefore she's going to have ego there.
Yep.
But it seems like she is trying to help this person. And
absolutely.
When the person is abusive, she just turns away because she knows there's no help. That could help this person. That could be for this person's sake. They've got to know they've got to control their mouth next time.
Right.
So it seems to be reasonable. You know?
Yeah. I mean, and then she is really nice to me most of the time, and sometimes she's abusive, but to everybody. But
I understand.
It seems if I just don't comment and let
that's
it go,
right, precisely.
It seems that
that's the point.
She'll calm down in a day or two, and then she'll be fine.
Yeah, but even that's not the push. You see, even that's not the issue. For our point of view, if we're seeing it as our personal practice,
right,
then there should be, there would be, if we're doing it as our own point, there'd be no expectation of them behaving better, doing it better. We just, whatever comes, comes, and we just, it's our practice. It's like, you know, it's right, into the boxing ring today and see right, how well you can do, you know? That's okay.
Yeah.
And that's your practice.
Yeah.
From the point of view of knowing what's useful for this person, that could be demand something else. It might demand you shout at her.
Yeah.
If you genuinely got the wisdom to know that would help her mind.
That's
not out of some vindictiveness.
Exactly.
But if from our point of view, best to be silent and quiet and practice patience and be grateful. From her point, to help her, it could be another behavior. It's like a child.
Yeah,
if your child, you know, tough love can be
yeah,
good, but you've got to have wisdom for tough love, not just anger.
Right.
That's a disaster. So it depends on what you're trying to achieve. Is it your own sake, your own practice, or is it for their sake? And that's depending on how clever we are and how wise we are. And it changes every day.
Exactly. Yeah, the more I practice.
Yeah, of course. That's right, exactly. That's right, exactly.
I can open my
And so the fact is, like Diane's talking, if we feel we're too fragile in the face of abusive people, or, you know, then keep away. But no, it's not their problem. No, it's your problem. It's your fault, not theirs, Diane. Remember that. I'm sorry, darling. That's the really brave attitude to take. You know it. I mean, we all know it. That's the brave attitude. But meanwhile, we leave the mothers alone out there. Not ready for you yet, babes, okay? Later. When you're a really good boxer. I mean, it's a tough one. It's just, again, all of it comes down to clarity, which comes down to awareness, which comes down to knowing your own mind. It has to start with this. Otherwise, it's a minefield out there, and we haven't got a clue, you know. We'll go crazy. Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
I heard a story yesterday, 2 days ago.
Yes, Ruth.
About a group of young people, boys and girls, teenagers, who were brought together. And the first thing that the leader did was ask each one to tell their story.
Uh-huh.
And at first they were a little shy, and then they got to talking about one who was gay and had a lot of people saying bad things at school. Another one whose parents were split up. Another one who got in trouble with drugs.
I understand.
And each one told their
uh-huh,
story.
Uh-huh.
And then they stayed together
uh-huh,
and they decided to do a project together
uh-huh,
and they did a gardening project.
Sure.
And over a period of
mm-hmm,
of several weeks,
mm,
this became a growing project
uh-huh,
that is being replicated
uh-huh,
in many places.
I see. Good.
And the person who was doing this was
yes,
someone from the American Friends Service Committee.
Uh-huh.
And they do a lot of work
good,
overseas
okay,
in reducing violence among different religious
among
groups.
Different groups of people. Wonderful. Isn't that good, Ruth? Thank you so much, darling. That's very good to know. Thank you, Ruth. So, okay, equanimity is this, again, simple. Keep it simple, is a recognition, a real clear understanding in our mind that the person who harms me and the person who's kind to me and the person who does neither are the same as each other from one point of view. There's millions of points of view, but the one that we're using as our basis. They wish to be happy and they don't wish to suffer. They wish to be happy and they don't wish to suffer. That's all. We're not saying they're the same in terms of their beauty or their height or their age or their talents or their relationship with me, which of course is the main one we think of. They're simply the same as each other from the wish to be happy and wish not to suffer. It's not a complicated concept. But to get to see this, even think it through, is really intense, isn't it? And this is why, like I'm saying, if we just begin with this one and realize that horrible person at work who really is so unkind, and we can see them unkind and all the rest, as soon as we think, well, Rabina, they want to be happy too, you know that. You think of your beloved, my beloved Mary, my dearest friend. I think Mary wants to be happy, and I really know Mary wants to be happy, and I'm happy to make Mary happy. That's easy. It comes easy. It comes easy. I see her. I have affection for her. She appears kind to me. She appears loving to me. I see her goodness. We make effort together. It's easy for me to see she wants to be happy, and I want to make her happy, which is love. The enemy, the one, the meanie, who's bringing up all my pain and my daggers and my hurt and my resentment, who's cruel to me, who's unkind, who doesn't see my good qualities, who doesn't praise me, who accuses me and doesn't appreciate my hard work. I mean, the minefield in that, my own hurt, my attachment, my resentment, my fears, my guilt, all of this is just huge. And so, of course, that is the filter that I'm using through which to see him, through which I see him. So he appears ugly, he appears mean. Whatever I'm feeling inside, if I see him as mean, that indicates what's something inside me. If I see him as a liar, that indicates something inside me. If he appears ugly, that's indicating something in me. If he's critical, that indicates something in me. So just thank him for one way to see this is another whole practice now, another discussion. But keep remembering, as Lama Zopa says, and this is back in the karma one, that the way people appear to, hear this, the way a person appears to us, and we're talking the enemy here, the way the enemy appears to us, this is the words they use, is in the aspect of whatever's in my mind. This is stunning. So forget whether he raped you. Forget whether he abused you. Forget the action he did. Forget that. That's not the discussion here, which sounds kind of shocking. However, the picture that person appears to in your mind, the picture that your mind is painting, put it this way, your mind is painting a picture of that person. And that's based on attachment, based on anger, based on jealousy, based on fear, based on resentment, based on bitterness. All of these are painting a picture of this ugly, awful person. Whatever we notice in that person is depending on what's in our mind. This is kind of shocking to hear this. If there's fear in my mind, he will appear as a terrifying person. If there's anger in my mind, he'll appear really ugly. If there's arrogance in my mind, I'll be really offended by him. If there's resentment in my mind, you watch it, just listen to it this way. This is the point. Now, we're not discussing whether or not he is evil. From his own point of view, he does do bad things. That's not the issue here. That is not the issue here. Please hear this. This is not the issue here, which is the one for ego. That's why we justify. But I'm right in seeing him this way because he did harm me. I'm right in seeing he is ugly because he did lie. I'm right in hating him because he did abuse me. This is the logic ego uses. And what we're trying to get past is that, which is shocking to us. However he appears to us is according to what's in my mind. This is so sobering, so terrifying to own it. So recognize that. Know that you're not capable of being around him because you haven't worked enough on your mind. Then be reasonable for yourself. Protect yourself. Keep away from him. But don't blame him. This is the part that's tough. And of course, if you have the view of karma, then that means every bit of this is what I've done to him in the past. Which is why remember those two young Tibetan nuns, I keep quoting, the ones who are in New York, remember Richard Gere invited all these, 10 years ago, all these ex-prisoners, you know, when I was working with people in prison, they invited a whole bunch of 20 ex-prisoners, Americans, black, white, Puerto Rican, a whole cross-section of United States citizens, you know. They met the Dalai Lama, the teachings, and they had an all-day meeting. It was very moving to hear all their experiences of suffering in prison and their racism and their sexism and their thisism and their thatism, whatever, all their pain and suffering of human beings. And then they invited two young Tibetan nuns who talked about their experience of being sexually abused and tortured in prison for a couple of years. And these young women talking about their experiences. So, of course, it was mean massive practice of exactly every word you're hearing in this room in real life. Was a real workshop for them. It was a genuine application of all their Buddhist views, the view of karma, the view of compassion, the view of forgiveness, the view of all this stuff we're talking about, the view of it, getting rid of attachment and anger and appearances and karmic blah, 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 all of it. Real, full-on, serious application of all this for them every day of that 2 years, being abused and sexually abused and tortured. So the first thing was, it was clear that when they talked, these young women, they weren't angry because they had the view of karma. And then second, finally, because also of the view of karma, as well as their practice of love and compassion, not to mention equanimity and all the rest, in this workshop of theirs for 2 years, like those television programs, what are they called? when it's real life. Reality, it was reality for 2 years, a reality nightmare, you know, for 2 years. It was real, wasn't a story. And it was actual practice, not in their heads. It was actual practice of equanimity, actual practice of forgiveness, actual practice of giving up attachment, actual practice of giving up ego, actual practice of love, compassion, Tonglen. You get my point here, not just in our heads, which is where we're training. Actual practice. And as they said, quietly, with tears in their eyes at the end of their talk, and of course, we had compassion for our torturers because we realized we had harmed them in the past. So way to go, people. Way to go. If we're that clever and that accomplished, whew, you know, one step at a time. One step at a time. Maybe they would have taken 100 lives to accomplish that if they had to do it quietly and slowly, but they were chucked in the deep end, weren't they? And we get chucked in the deep end sometimes, don't we? And we often are surprised at the level of our capability. When we're really up against the wall, it's amazing what we can accomplish. And this is what I'm seeing with my friends in prison. Not trying to say they're all perfect, but the ones who really did practice. Living in these garbage dumps, you know. Especially the ones wrongly accused, all this kind of thing. The garbage dump of their lives. One small mistake and then there you are on death row, you know. So they would have taken a lot longer to accomplish internally what they've been forced to accomplish internally, stuck in these places. So really, how amazing. I mean, I just saw my friend Mitch. I saw Mitch on death row in Eddyville, in Kentucky. Well, no, 2 days ago. And we were cracking jokes. We always just laugh a lot, the two of us. And we were cracking jokes about his situation. There he is on death row, you know. And we were talking about having a perfect human rebirth, you know, the way they talk about all the list of all the things, the 18 things, the leisures and fortune they talk about, you know, in the text you read about, all the qualities of a precious human rebirth. And we were ticking it all off. And he said, I wasn't sure about this leisure. What do you mean by leisure? You know, I explained the perfect human rebirth. And then we were agreeing that he's got one. He's got all the qualities. He doesn't have to work. The taxpayers look after him. He doesn't have to wash his clothes. He has one set of red clothes, you know. He makes his bed. He jogs around the thing. He takes care of his 40 friends on death row. He's like their best friend. He really takes care of people. He's amazing. He has his 3 meals a day. Maybe not the best food, but he gets 3 meals a day. He doesn't have to work. He's got the most luxurious life from that point of view. And he feels genuinely grateful. He feels genuinely blessed. Because he has all the characteristics of an excellent life, because he's got the leisure now to spend all day doing his practice, studying his Dharma, getting ready for death, as well as helping people. He sends things, he's allowed to use the workshop, he makes sculptures for friends and little things and drawings for his grandkids. So he spends his life as a pure Dharma practitioner, like a monk basically. So he's very, very, very fortunate. The world wouldn't think so. You understand my point? We have to be out here, you know, 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day working to get money in the bank, to pay the mortgage, to pay the food, all the things just to eat, so that if you have an hour left, you might come to class. He doesn't have to do any of that. He's far more blessed. I'm not being sarcastic. We'll all die anyway. Except that he'll get killed by somebody, that's all. And he gets a bit of warning so he can be more prepared. So he's even fortunate from that point of view. Are you with me, people?
Yeah.
He feels this himself. I'm not telling him to think this. He feels it. He appreciates it. He's hilariously funny. He's wonderful, Mitch. And he's on death row. So it sounds like madness, right? And then my other friend, the other one, because there's a whole bunch of them came to the talk, Leif, another man, he's a Catholic. He said, well, they've saved my life. I'd be dead if I were out on the street. So he's happy too. He's grateful. So everything is proved emptiness. Everything's just view, isn't it? How you see it. And Mitch chooses to see his life this way, so he's a happy guy, I tell you. He's quite content. I'm sincere here. I'm not being sarcastic. So there you go. Anyway, that was that. Equanimity. Back to equanimity. How we see people. Yeah, this is the one. How we see people. How a person appears to us. That's the better way to say it. You see, our problem is if we never look into our minds and we have the usual view, Buddha would call it the samsaric view, we just say, there's an ugly person. Why are they ugly, Rabina? Well, they harm me. No one's going to argue with you. That's faulty. That's perfect logic for the world. And this is the world's logic, and all Buddha's saying is he's arguing with this. He's arguing with it. He's arguing with it. You know? So remember, we have to keep remembering, and this is from the karmic point of view, earlier on in our practice, how a person appears to us. Okay, there's a difference here. There's two things. One is the actions you can see a person do. which is evident to anybody. So there's a person who does stab somebody. There's a person who does steal money. There's a person who does, you know, harm you, shout at you, use abusive words. That's a fact that you can prove easily. That's not the appearance. That is true, relatively speaking. The person did do those actions. That's not the meaning of how the person appears to you. It's whether they appear ugly or beautiful to you. That's the part that's shocking to us. We think, of course they appear ugly to me and fearful. Of course I'm scared of them. Of course I hate them. Of course I'm jealous. Of course I'm resentful. Do you understand? Which is how, because of those states of mind, they, although those states of mind are painting a picture of ugly person, fearful person, horrible person. And that's the point we're talking here. Yes, they did shoot you. They did harm you. They did lie to you. They did cheat on you. That's not being disputed. And this is the part that's shocking. Because we use that as the logic for why they must be ugly, and why they are ugly, and why they appear ugly, and why they're ugly in their bones. No, Buddha says. They appear that way to you because you've got delusions. And that's the part that's so sobering. Like, we're talking to Dion. This is too scary for us. It's that's right. It's awful, isn't it? It's too much. I mean, we can't escape, Dion. We are the boss, baby. This is the one, but that's the good sign. It is too much, isn't it? The fact is, people are horrible. The world is full of horrible people doing horrible things. That's not the discussion. So to change the way they appear to my eyes and my mind is the job we're discussing here. That's what changing my mind means. So this equanimity one, it's based upon giving up attachment, anger, jealousy, and all the rest before. So it's actually really high. This is a tough one, you know. It's very tough, but this is the Buddha's view. And that's why those young women, that 2 years must have been grueling. No pretending. It must have been a nightmare for them. But because they had an interpretation of it, the Buddha's view, this has happened to us, therefore it's happening. It's happened to me now because I've done it before. This is the logic, the fundamental starting point of the logic for a Buddhist. There's no way anything in the universe would happen to me if I didn't create the cause for it. No way. Not possible. Impossible from the Buddhist point of view. And this is entrenched, of course, in their minds. This is their view, their default mode view of the world. Like our default mode view of the world is I'm an innocent victim who didn't ask to get born, therefore it's all out there. So therefore that enabled them to bear the suffering, and to that means that's the practice of patience. And they see, this is another one. This is patience, sounds like a cute word, you know. It's outrageously difficult, patience. And what it is very clear. Patience is like an intelligent state of mind that sees that this is happening, this thing that is not what my attachment wants. That's what anger is. Anger is the response when your attachment doesn't get what it wants. And the millisecond that thing arises in front of you, which attachment doesn't want, that's what appears ugly to you, and that's what triggers aversion, like right there. So patience is grabbing that ugly thing, and instead of running away from it, you go towards it and greet it and welcome it. That's what patience is. It's massive. It's not just gritting your teeth and hoping it'll go away. That's called passive aggression. That's not patience. Patience is in your mind, actually, when that thing comes that you know the attachment is completely hysterically not wanting, and so that's what the panic attack is when you discover that painful thing that happened, and he did that thing, you know, he stole my money, and the devastation, and the pain, and the anger, the rage, the hurt, whatever it might be. Then patience is the welcoming of it. It's an active practice. In the early stages, this is too much of a practice. You don't try to, you just keep, you avoid the problem. You try and control your body and speech and don't go berserk. When we're really advanced, up in the compassion wing, they talk about this practice of patience. Or the job of greeting the thing that you call bad.
and seeing it as good. This is what those nuns would have been able to do, practice doing. Actually, this is good. Probably sounds hysterical. Of course, it's all practice. It doesn't happen naturally. So this is also based on emptiness. This is what's really hard to see, you know. Because ego grasping, the delusion that runs the show, assumes that that thing out there is bad from its own side. In and of itself, Fred is bad. He is wrong. He is ugly. He is an abuser. He is that. In his bones. Definitely. Having nothing to do with me. Having nothing to do with whether I label him this. We don't think, well, this is real emptiness. I don't think I'm labeling Fred as ugly. I think he is ugly. And I think I'm just observing the truth. I don't think it's a label coming from my mind at all, do I? I think, what do you mean I'm seeing him as ugly? He is ugly. Are you hearing my words? That's so the one that says my mind is labeling him ugly is the actual application of the teaching of emptiness. He's ugly because I see him as ugly. There's another way of saying he appears to me in the aspect of what's in my mind. It's like so sobering. And so patience, or transforming problems into happiness, as they call it, you know, when you're trying to do all these practices, all this stuff that we're discussing here. I'm leaping ahead now. Never mind. Is the practice of transforming problems is greeting the bad thing. Keep away from Fred still. It's okay. I'm talking about your mind, like these women in the prison. If these guys could have stopped torturing them, I'm sure they would have been most grateful. So it was extra hard for them because they had to be living with the torturers, you know. They couldn't stop them. So even for us, you know, you just keep away from Fred. But in your mind, you're seeing this as good. So what's the logic of this? It sounds too perverse for us. Why is it, from what perspective is it logical? Only from the perspective of a person who's trying to give up attachment and the delusions. That's why, obvious. From the perspective of wanting that your practice is giving up attachment, giving up delusions. From that perspective, then obviously an enemy is good. It's logic, absolute logic, like you're saying. People have been saying it. But you've got to be brave to do this one. It could make you insane if you're not ready. As Mavongo Rinpoche says, you've got to be a suitable vessel to do this kind of practice. If you're living in that relationship with an abuser and you're a complete victim and you're overwhelmed by pain and you've got no self-awareness, no self-respect, self-loathing, rage and anger, fear, then you are not ready to see this as good. This will be the wrong practice for you. You've got to see it as bad and get the hell out as quick as possible. Have the courage to say, excuse me, mate, I'm leaving. And that's why a victim, we don't like to blame victims. We don't know, we think it sounds like blaming a victim. But victim would not be, I mean, we talked about this one, would not be a victim without an oppressor. An oppressor can't be an oppressor without a victim. So it's like this awful game we're playing together. It sounds so terrifying, you know. So a victim's got to become brave and say, I'm in control, I'm going to leave. But a person who's not a victim, who is brave, who has worked on their mind, can say, this is good that Fred abused me. This is good that he left me. Why? Well, it's obvious. Just like I always use Lance Armstrong as my example, even though he's a naughty boy now. I always use Lance Armstrong as this. I remember reading in the New Yorker about how he had like zero fat on his body. He's like a real fanatic, you know. So I like the example. I like fanatics. So for Lance Armstrong, we know that the high mountains, he adores them. They'd kill most people, right? Do you see what I'm saying? He greeted the problem, like hungrily greeted the problem and kept pushing. That's the one of, you know, seeing problems as good. Because you want to give up attachment. If he didn't want to be the best cyclist, then it would have been insane to do this. Better to just coast down the mountain. So if you're attempting to give up attachment and all the rest, then this is an amazingly powerful practice. An amazing one. It would smash ego as quick as possible. Quick as possible. The quickest way. In your mind. Keep away from Fred. Still. In your mind, be glad. Be grateful. Actually, that's the practice of patience. Whew, it's intense, isn't it? And why? Because it's smashing your ego grasping, smashing attachment,
smashing delusions. But you've got to be ready for that. We've got to know our own capacity, you know, take ourselves at our own pace. So we begin with thinking it. Even though your heart's breaking, you start to say the words. You start redefining this experience. Instead of falling into the trap of ego's view of this, that you're right to think these people are horrible because they are horrible. No. Yes, they are horrible. But we know why they're horrible. But we think they're horrible because they're horrible to me. So we take it personally. And therefore we hold on to our view that they're horrible. So it's kind of tough stuff, you know. This is why I say having a good heart sounds so cute. But this is the stuff underneath a kind heart, okay? It's very painful. Oh, it's lunchtime. Meanwhile, have a break. We can have lunch. It's late, I'm sorry. Look, it's 12:08. So make this lunch discussion. If you want to discuss all this, you want to be quiet. If you don't want to discuss this, be quiet. You can talk about the politicians and the football later. And if you do want to talk, have your lunch and be in little groups and talk about this business. Try and stick, well, I mean, we've talked about a lot, but try and stick to any one of these things that we discussed to bring it up and talk about it, you know. I always remember hearing when I was studying with my philosophy teacher, Geshe Tetchok, he said, always quoted, he'd always say, 25% of what you get comes from listening. 75% of what you get comes from what they call debate, discussion, thinking about it and meditating on it. So it's very beneficial to discuss. Okay. So maybe 1:30 we come back. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And then we think about lunch differently. Because what we're trying to do is think differently. Let's see lunch from another point of view. Lunch appears to us now in the aspect of attachment mostly in our mind. So we change the view in the mind. We'll see it from the perspective of compassion. Okay? So we think of all the people who prepared the lunch, walked out early to prepare the lunch. So we think of the people who brought the lunch, the people who cooked it, made it, cut it, buttered it, fixed it, you know, shopped for it, the people who trucked it from the places to the shops, all the sentient beings going back and back who have been involved in this little bit of lunch out there. Just that for a second, which is true, countless sentient beings. This is the handiwork of many, many, many sentient beings. This is a fact. So we don't see that so much because we just see whether it's the object of my attachment or not. That's what blinds us. So we remember, we're trying to see it this way, the handiwork of many, many people. So if your precious children had made this lunch, even if it was disgusting, you'd be happy to eat it, wouldn't you, for their sake? You would never criticize it, would you? You'd think these kind, sweet children, oh, darling, it's so delicious. Wouldn't you say that? Well, think like that. That your precious children have made this lunch for you, especially for you. You'll all be weeping in tears in happiness and enjoy the food that you normally wouldn't enjoy. Okay? That's your practice to eat lunch. Thank you. Oh, we're going to have a photo. Oh, Lord. Oh, not today. Oh, okay, good. Oh, tomorrow. Oh, okay. We just want a photo. You better come tomorrow in the group. We should be taking photos every day. Different photos, group photos, easy going. Have you been doing that? Shots of the room?
Yeah, David.
Has been doing that. Good. Okay, great. Lovely. Okay, I'll see you in an hour and a half or so. Thank you, sweethearts.